Minnesota Court of Appeals is now in session. Judge Larkin, Judge Larson, Judge Bentley, Honorable Michelle A. Larkin presiding.
Thank you. Please be seated. Good morning and welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals, the 16th day of April, 2025. We have three cases on our calendar for oral arguments this morning. The first is Tanner versus BNSF. Would counsel for appellant please approach the podium and state your name for the record before beginning your argument. And if anybody needs to, the podium can be raised or lowered to make it a more comfortable height for you. I think the buttons are down in front.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chuck Spivak, Your Honor, from the Marin Gear Law Firm on behalf of the appellant, Burlington Northern Santa Fe Railway Company.
You may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, counsel, again, Chuck Spivak on behalf of the appellant. Your Honor, is getting right to the point, we acknowledge that the Minnesota Supreme Court's 1991 decision in Rykoff-Sexson holds against us. But for over 100 years, the Minnesota Supreme Court has recognized the primacy of federal decisions on the question of the exercise of personal jurisdiction, noting in its 1915 decision in Atkinson that personal jurisdiction is a, quote, federal question ruled by federal decisions. Your task in this case, I submit this, then, is not to simply apply a decision of the Minnesota Supreme Court returned 34 years ago, but to decide whether the holding in that decision remains good law in light of decisions of the United States Supreme Court returned in the intervening years. And I submit the Minnesota Supreme Court wants you to make that determination. For when it declined to accept accelerated review in this case, we must assume that it didn't intend for us to essentially spin our wheels here at the intermediate appellate court level by having you simply apply Rykoff-Sexson by rote.
Do you have an example of a situation where our court has decided not to follow a binding Minnesota Supreme Court case because of intervening U.S. Supreme Court precedent that's not directly on point?
It's an interesting question, Your Honor. We looked, and I'm not sure that necessarily there isn't one that we didn't find, but we looked specifically with regard to personal jurisdiction because that's a situation where the Minnesota Supreme Court has already said that what we say actually isn't controlling. It's what the U.S. Supreme Court would ultimately say. And I think this would be a matter of first impression in that regard. But again, Your Honors, we have to look at the practicalities of the situation. We know that for well over 100-
Well, I guess I'm confused by why the Mallory decision is inconsistent with Rykoff-Sexson explicitly, right? I think that it might be true that if in Mallory the court had said consent jurisdiction is not a thing, consent jurisdiction is unconstitutional, that maybe you come to this court and you can say, yes, the Supreme Court has Rykoff-Sexson, but that has been directly overruled by Mallory, which said there's no such thing as consent jurisdiction. I think that we're in a different situation here where you're asking for sort of a factual nuance to be derived from Mallory, and that seems to me a somewhat different question when it comes to us directly deciding something contrary to a precedential case from the Minnesota Supreme Court.
I understand Your Honor's question. I point out this with regard to Mallory. So Mallory dealt specifically with the facts before it, and the facts before it involved a statute where the express was explicit.
But I'm not quite sure that that's true, because if you look at the Mallory decision, if you look at Part 4 of the plurality court acknowledges sort of the idea of implicit consent. And then when you go to Justice Alito's concurrence, he specifically talks about, and I'll get the direct quote here, previous authoritative construction of state law. And so I'm not sure why there isn't a majority opinion with regard to a statute like Minnesota's, where the Supreme Court has previously interpreted our statute in a way that confers consent jurisdiction to your client, and your client was certainly on notice that this had been the interpretation of our court.
Yeah, again, Your Honor, we understand that Mallory consisted of a number of different opinions rendered by members of the court. It was eventually a 5-4 decision, and if you look at one of the issues, which I'm going to address in a moment, it actually flipped 5-4 in favor of what would have been a reversal on the grounds raised in this case that wasn't addressed in the Mallory case. But again, my point with regard to Mallory is that while the court may have mused with regard to other statutes, It was considering a statute before it where the consent was explicit. And as a result, it didn't have to directly address the idea that we're raising here. And that is that if a fundamental right is going to be limited by state statute, this fundamental right with regard to the exercise of personal jurisdiction as set forth in Goodyear and in Daimler is going to be limited by state statute, that statute should be explicit in its operation. Our point is the constitutional right should not be eliminated by inference. Or put
well,
another way.
Just quickly to push back on that, I mean, there's a footnote in Mallory, which is in Section 3B, that's the majority holding, right? Footnote 5 says, neither Pennsylvania Fire nor our later decisions applying it nor our precedents approving other forms of consent to personal jurisdiction have ever imposed some sort of magic words requirement. So, like, that idea that you don't need they're not hanging on necessarily the words of the statute saying consent to personal jurisdiction, but you look at the effect of what the statute is. So why isn't that, if anything, reaffirming the constitutionality of a statute like this?
I've read that footnote several times, Your Honor, and I'm not sure that that footnote necessarily means that it could apply to a statute that is silent in terms of an agreement to have the exercise of personal jurisdiction. Our statute in Minnesota just says that if you're going to do business in this state, you agree to appoint a registered agent for service of process. And whether the magic language that was talking about in Mallory was that which was in the Pennsylvania statute or maybe something different, I don't necessarily agree that I read that footnote as saying that the majority is saying that, look, we're looking at Pennsylvania, which is explicit. We're also saying that any statute that requires the for the conducting of business, the appointment of a registered agent for service of process is going to be fine with us. It's going to work just fine with regard to Pennsylvania Fire, which was decided in 1917.
Can you remind me, and actually I'm trying to look for it quickly here. Can you remind me what the statute in Pennsylvania Fire said? Did that use the words personal jurisdiction in the same way that the statute at issue in Mallory did?
I don't believe that it did, Your Honor. I believe that back in 1917, that statute, although I can't recall off the top of my head, but I do not believe that it dealt with a Pennsylvania statute at the time.
I think it was maybe a Missouri statute.
Correct.
The case just where I can try and look for it, but I was just curious because it seems like in Mallory what they're really saying is they're just double downing on Pennsylvania Fire. So I'd be curious for looking at that statute and whether that looks more like Minnesota's statute. Or.
Yep.
So do you agree that our statute, Minnesota's statute at least, implies an exercise of personal jurisdiction by referring to acceptance of service, but your position is it would need to explicitly say you are subject to the personal jurisdiction of the courts?
I would say, Your Honor, that what I think with regard to that as to whether it implies it or not, I'm not sure that it makes a big difference because the Minnesota Supreme Court has said that it does imply, right?
Since at least the 1920s.
So the umpire that eventually is going to rule whether I'm going to argue the ball or strike or not doesn't make that much difference. The umpire in this case says that it does impliedly infer a consent to jurisdiction in the state.
Which is authoritative case law interpreting our statute since at least the 1920s, which you would concede that your client is on notice of that interpretation of the law at the time that it decides to register in this state.
And my point being, Your Honor, that...
And so with regard to thinking about this in the context of consent, Your client, at the time that they're registering their business here, understands that one of the implications of registering it is the fact that our Supreme Court has interpreted the statute in this way, right? I mean, you see where I'm going. It's like once we're in consent world, then sort of the fact that this has been interpreted for such a long period of time becomes a troublesome fact maybe for your client.
But, Your Honor, I think you're looking at the wrong time frame because the key here now is what was the nature of the consent at the time this accident happened. And at the time this accident happened, Goodyear and Daimler had been decided. And had Burlington Northern decided that, well, all right, the law hasn't changed and we have to decide whether we want to continue to do business in the state in light of the inferred decision in Rykoff-Sexson, then it could have made that informed decision. But my point being is that whatever the Supreme Court said in Rykoff-Sexson is to be interpreted through the lens of federal decisions that are rendered subsequent to Rykoff-Sexson. Thus, it would be reasonable for BNSF to conclude at the time of this accident that Rykoff-Sexson no longer controlled its activities with regard consent to personal jurisdiction in this state.
Don't that, like, the Daimler Goodyear cases don't deal with consent jurisdiction, right?
Correct.
Those are minimum contacts.
General jurisdiction cases.
Yeah. So why are those even relevant?
It's relevant, Your Honor, because, again, my point is this. If a fundamental right, and the fundamental right is that established by Daimler, that a foreign corporation should only be charged to be brought into court in a state that it considers to be at home, and that it doesn't consider itself to be at home in every state in which it happens to do business, and that there has to be sufficient contacts with that state for it to be considered at home. And we know that from the standpoint of general jurisdiction, Minnesota can't be considered to be BNSF's home because BNSF has less contacts in Minnesota than it did in Montana, and the Supreme Court ruled that BNSF can't be considered to be at home in Montana. So now the question is that fundamental right to be able to be sued in a state where you're considered to be at home abrogated by a state statute? And in this case, that state statute only required Burlington Northern to register an agent for service of process.
Which had been interpreted by our Supreme Court for 100 years to confer personal jurisdiction.
I understand that, Your Honor. And,
consistent. And not just one time. I mean, the Supreme Court has repeatedly interpreted our statutes as conferring personal jurisdiction by consent.
Has
the Minnesota Supreme Court looked at this issue since the United States Supreme Court said, yes, this confers consent jurisdiction,
looking at
a statute that actually referred to being subject to the jurisdiction of the courts of the state?
Not head on, right. Your Honor.
So your argument is, although our statute implies personal jurisdiction, the Supreme Court of Minnesota has said so, the United States Supreme Court has since issued a decision which indicates that perhaps an implied concession of personal jurisdiction is not good enough. There has to be an express concession under the language of the statute.
Could not have said it better myself.
The next question is, well, maybe that's the question the Supreme Court should decide, but here we are.
I think the Supreme Court is asking for your input on that. Again, had the Supreme Court not wanted you to exercise some level of academic approach to this, it would not have denied the petition for accelerated review.
Well, I mean, I don't know that we can read so much into that order. I mean, they may have denied it for any number of reasons, even just to get an impression about whether, to what extent Supreme Court case law is binding or applicable here, right?
You could almost consider yourself, although I apologize for any inferred insult, as a United States magistrate putting together an advisory opinion for the Article III judge to rule upon. But for whatever reason, the Minnesota Supreme Court wanted you to rule on this first. And we can disagree as to what its intent was, but I doubt it wanted you simply to just rubber stamp Rykoff-Sexson. Let me make two points, one about Mallory and one about why it is that we should look critically at the Rykoff-Sexson decision. And the first point I'm going to make is not my own. It's a point that was made by the Second Circuit Court of Appeals in Brown versus Lockheed Martin Corporation. In that case, Judges Parker, Lynch, and Carney said this: if mere registration and accompanying appointment of an in-state agent without express consent to general jurisdiction nonetheless suffice to confer general jurisdiction by implicit consent, every corporation will be subject to general jurisdiction in every state in which it registers, and Daimler's ruling would be robbed of meaning by backdoor thief. And that's exactly the point that we're making here. Between the time that Rykoff-Sexson was decided and now, we have the Goodyear and Daimler cases who have told us that we're skeptical of how this is supposed to be applied. And this is exactly what would happen. If we apply Rykoff-Sexson by rote, then Daimler is robbed of meaning by backdoor thief. Secondly, we have raised a dormant Commerce Clause argument. And in that regard, we're in the majority in Mallory, because in that case, Justice Alito joined the four dissenters in concluding that statutes like 303.06 that purportedly expand the application of general jurisdiction violate the Commerce Clause. What Justice Alito said was that requiring a foreign corporation to defend itself with regard to all transactions, including those with no foreign connection, violates the clause or could violate the clause.
I guess I don't understand that there's a majority opinion on that. I see that a little bit more as a dicta question. But my issue with that is that the Justice Alito is relying on Davis. And Davis was a Minnesota case which was then addressed by our Supreme Court in Irving, where Irving said that under our state's application of the law, that it doesn't violate Davis because the process server is not a mere soliciting agent. Our Supreme Court then went on to say that it does not offend the Commerce Clause where the business is doing extensive business. This was a railroad company, has miles of track and numerous employees, has a designated agent, and has consented to service a process in the state. And why, as the Intermediate Court of Appeals, are we not bound to follow Irving in this case?
Well, both Davis and Irving, Your Honor, although I may look like I was around when they were decided, were well before my time. And thus, they were also well before Goodyear, they were well before Daimler, and they were well before Tyrell, which talks about the nature of the comment of the contacts that are necessary.
But none of those are Commerce Clause cases.
I understand.
And I think Justice Alito is sort of trying to carve out a potential new path based on Davis. And I think that the problem is that we're sitting in Minnesota, and so our court had to wrestle with Davis. And as an intermediate appellate court, it feels like we're sort of stuck with that old wrestling of what the implications of that decision were for our state.
I appreciate that Justice Alito was musing as to an issue that wasn't directly before the court, but what he said was pretty clear. There is a good prospect that Pennsylvania's assertion of jurisdiction here over an out-of-state company in a suit brought by an out-of-state plaintiff on claims wholly unrelated to Pennsylvania violates the Commerce Clause. And that's the same facts that we have here. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Counsel. Could you introduce yourself for the record before you begin your argument, sir?
Yes, Your Honor. My name is Chris Moreland. I'm here with my colleague, Paula Josart, on behalf of Respondent Tanner Lynn. May it please the court, counsel. I want to kind of just take a step back before we start and to note kind of what the discussion has been so far. So the Minnesota Supreme Court, as we all know, has described consent jurisdiction as, quote, one of the oldest tenets of personal jurisdiction. And it's been blessed and applied without exception since Rykoff-Sexton 33 years ago. And in fact, even longer than that, going back to the United States Supreme Court case of United States versus Pennsylvania Fire in 1917. Minnesota Supreme Court has also held that statutes like Minnesota's, which extract from non-resident corporations as a condition of performing some activity in the state, consent to personal jurisdiction, do comport with the due process clause and thus pose none of the constitutional concerns that BNSF has tried to raise here. Same goes for their dormant commerce clause argument, which has been considered and rejected repeatedly by our state Supreme Court dating back to, as Your Honor mentioned, the Irving case, also the ex rel Shendel versus Lyon County, which we talked about in our brief extensively. So as far as where we're at with respect to jurisprudence on both consent jurisdiction and the Commerce Clause, the Minnesota and United States Supreme Courts are in lockstep in that regard.
Here's my question with regard to the Commerce Clause question. There certainly has been a development in constitutional law for how we analyze dormant Commerce Clause questions post-Irving. And so is it appropriate for us to simply rely on Irving with regard to the Commerce Clause analysis, or do we need to conduct the sort of modern dormant Commerce Clause analysis that's been developed by the U.S. Supreme Court since the 1920s?
Sure, and that's obviously a fair question. I think, number one, when you get into the question relative to the examination of the Dormant Commerce Clause, we're not just looking at the Minnesota Supreme Court here. We're also looking at the United States Supreme Court, particularly in FILA cases. And that's Miles versus Illinois Central, which we discussed at length in our brief as well. And what the court said there is when you look at the FILA, which incorporates a very broad jurisdictional venue statute, which says, you know, plaintiffs who are injured in FILA cases can sue the railroad in any district in which it is doing business at the time of the accident. It goes on to say, you know, the FILA finds its genesis in the Commerce Clause itself. And the FILA has, in fact, as the Minnesota Supreme Court noted in X Rail Shandell v. Lyon, they talked about a Missouri case, the name escapes me, Hoffman versus Farish or something like that. It's in our brief. But the FILA was challenged on a constitutional basis relative to that distribution of concurrent jurisdiction between the state and federal courts. The Missouri Supreme Court said, no, it's fine. The United States Supreme Court refused to take it up. And the Minnesota Supreme Court in X Rail Shandell said, because of that, we've considered this issue to be decided. But I've digressed a little bit away from Miles, which again is the United States Supreme Court, and it has said, because the FILA finds itself its genesis in the Commerce Clause, and because the FILA is an appropriate exercise of Congress's authority under the Commerce Clause, it cannot be that the concurrent jurisdiction would create a situation whereby if in federal court there is no argument about jurisdiction, there cannot be an argument in the state court in the same district. They say that doesn't make sense. So I mean, I'm not sure if I answered your question, but in the context of FILA, this has been addressed both at the Minnesota State Supreme Court and United States Supreme Court level in the context of
FILA. In the context of the Commerce Clause.
Context of the Commerce Clause.
So yeah. Do we need to use the three-part test articulated by the United States Supreme Court to determine whether Minnesota's statute violates the Dormant Commerce Clause?
Not in the context of this FILA case, I would say no. And I would say if that's an issue that needs to be decided, it's one for further review at the Supreme Court. In the context of this decision, you know, there is no error that was committed by the district court. It correctly applied binding Minnesota and Supreme Court precedent, and therefore...
So you're saying the three-part test doesn't apply to this type of case because case law says there is jurisdiction, or there is no Commerce Clause
problem relative to the FILA per the United States Supreme Court. The other thing I wanted to kind of delve back into, and, you know, Judge Bentley, you made a good point, as of course all your points are good, but the question relative to the statutory language at issue in Pennsylvania Fire, right? Because what the Supreme Court said in Mallory, and we can talk about the specificity of the Pennsylvania statute, and it certainly is different than the Minnesota statute, but what the Pennsylvania, or what the court said in Mallory, in addition to saying we've never required express language to consent, we've never required any kind of magic words. That's a quote that you brought up, Judge Larson, and that's kind of the point. But in Pennsylvania Fire versus Gold Issue Mining, there was no express consent provision. It did not mention personal jurisdiction. It did not mention general jurisdiction. And I don't want to necessarily stand here and read to you, but you did ask about it. And so the Missouri statute specifically said, quote, any insurance company not incorporated or organized under the laws of this state desiring to transact any business by any agent or agents in this state shall first file with the superintendent of the insurance department a written instrument or power of attorney duly signed and sealed, appointing and authorized said superintendent to acknowledge or receive service of process issued from any court of record, justice of the peace, or other inferior court, and upon whom such process may be served for and in behalf of such company. Service of process as aforesaid issued by any such court as aforesaid upon the superintendent shall be valid. So they were a lot wordier back in 1917, but the point is that
no express reference.
No express reference at all. And given that the Mallory court said, hey, you know, some cases present new issues. This case does not. We decided this 100 years ago in Pennsylvania Fire. We're simply reaffirming that that's the status of the law. And so that gets into the context of you know, Judge Bentley, you also asked a question at the top of counsel about intervening Supreme Court precedents and whether or not, you know, those have a bearing on what we're here talking about today. And I would take issue a little bit just with the semantics of that because there really haven't been any intervening precedents relative to consent jurisdiction. All the cases that the BNS is talking about are general jurisdiction cases. And in most instances, the Supreme Court in those cases, including Tyrell, said, you know, we're not looking at that. We're not here to talk about that. And not that it doesn't matter. Tyrell happened to be my case, and I tried very hard to get the Montana Supreme Court to, to talk to me about consent jurisdiction, and they decided they weren't terribly interested in that, which is their right. But the point in mentioning that is simply to say that if these two things were, in fact, the same, and the general jurisdiction analysis of minimum contacts and being essentially at home and paradigm fora really kind of leaking into the consent jurisdiction analysis, you would have seen something like that in Mallory. And they said, no, all of this stuff is, the Supreme Court obviously knows what they've done with the world of general jurisdiction since 1917. And they said, no, none of that matters. This is Pennsylvania Fire again. And the similarities between our statute currently and the Pennsylvania Fire statute are, you know, pretty, you can't really drive a big wedge between those things. So to the extent that there's an argument about express language, I think that fails. I would also kind of point out, you know, with respect to the Dormant Commerce Clause argument and the Davis case, and I don't know if there's any additional questions about that, but Davis, again, the difference there was statutory language. And this statute that we're dealing with has been in effect in one form or another since, as Judge Larson noted, since the 1920s. And that was the basis for the rejection of the Commerce Clause arguments in Irving and in State X Rel v. Shendell v. Lyon County.
What are the legitimate local interests in having courts have jurisdiction over a company when the dispute happens somewhere else, the parties are located somewhere else, and they're not at home?
Sure, and we talked about this in our brief as well, and this is not, you know, the railroad, and particularly the BNSF, right, they're not some kind of localized enterprises, so artificially drawing a state line between where something is sued and where something happened is a little bit tough, right, conceptually. However, I understand that it's a, you know, it's a legitimate question to ask, but as we've kind of laid out in our brief, this case in particular has a lot of connections to Minnesota in that the plaintiff, Mr. Lynn, works out of the Twin Cities Division. The decisions that were made relative to what he was doing at the time of his incident that caused his injury, the equipment that he was using, his supervisors, all being made out of here in Minneapolis, right? In addition, the BN, you know, touts itself as this kind of paragon of economic prosperity for the state of Minnesota, and those materials are referenced in our brief as well. So the interest that Minnesota has, in addition to the fact that the FILA says you can do this, and courts in this state have continuously recognized that, state Supreme Court, this court, district courts, the interest that you have is regulating companies that do a ton of business in your state and making sure that they act the way that they're supposed to act.
But so I guess that seems somewhat tied to the facts of this case. Like, let's just take it out of the facts here. And if we're talking about the Commerce Clause, you know, let's say it was not. It's a business or railroad that is registered here but doesn't have a lot of employees that come in and out, don't have a lot of trains that run through the employee. The injury happened in Ohio. What's the benefit there?
Sure.
Just the registration?
I mean, I guess my answer would be that's a little bit tougher, of course, right? You can always draw a distinction and come up with a hypothetical where you're getting to the outer edges of what might be.
But don't do it at the Commerce, sure. Maybe even just at the Commerce Clause level, do you even look at the facts like that? Like, could we make a different decision under the Commerce Clause if there's a lot of people here working in Minnesota but not related to this injury, or maybe they are tangentially versus
sure.
somebody else? Because isn't the Commerce Clause kind of a, we're looking at it from a higher level than that, right?
Sure. I don't think there's a basis for a distinction. The only reason I'm talking about these particular factual relations to the case is because of the reliance that the BNSF has placed on the Davis case and the different nature of the statute there, where they did find that if you simply have an agent here soliciting business, but you're not doing anything in the state, that under the Commerce Clause becomes a problem, right? They're going to say that's not good enough. Under the Minnesota statute that exists now that applies in this case, the court again, up and down the board, has said that is sufficient. So I would say that the facts and the nature and extent of the contacts don't necessarily make a difference, but in this case, they're relevant because of the arguments being made. Does that make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And I would also note, you know, with respect to kind of the notion that, you know, there's some commentary in the brief about the railroad not knowing why this case was filed here and all those kind of things, and we just talked about that. But the other thing that kind of is worth mentioning is that, you know, the BNSF is certainly not any kind of babe in the woods, right? They're a sophisticated litigant. They've been here numerous times. But there are processes, both federally and state, that they can take when they don't think a case is in the right place. Federally, obviously, that's a 1404 transfer motion. State court, they could make a motion for forum nonconvenience. So they're talking about being deprived of some constitutional right, which I think is not the correct analysis here under the law. The district court simply followed binding precedent. But it's not like they are truly left without some kind of ability to protect themselves from cases that they truly think are in the wrong place, right? So here they went the jurisdictional route, which is certainly an argument that they can make. I don't think it prevails here, but we'll see what happens, I guess, at the decision phase and with what comes. But they certainly had every opportunity to do other things to protect themselves, which they chose not to do. So there's no surprise, there's no unfairness, they're not being deprived of constitutional rights by the simple application at the district court level of binding precedent. And the last point I think I would make is with respect to what the Supreme Court may or may not want us to do here relative to its, you know, decision not to accept accelerated review, I do think that it's dangerous to read into that. There are specific standards that have to be met for the Supreme Court to look at this. And all they did was look at it and say, this is pretty clear, you're not close, so come back to us later. I think. I'm not on the Supreme Court. I'm standing here in a suit talking to you. But I do think it's dangerous to kind of give that more, I guess, thought than what it's worth. So in summary, you know, I think the law is clear on both counts relative to the continuing viability of you know, consent jurisdiction as a separate and independent doctrine. The entirety of the railroad's position here relies on kind of conflation or agreeing that general jurisdiction and consent jurisdiction are now merged, which I think was very clearly rejected by the Supreme Court in Mallory. And the same with the Dormant Commerce Clause. It's just 100 years of precedent that mandates the affirmance of the district court order as the district court simply applied that precedent to the facts before it. Thank you.
Your Honors, I'd like to start with this proposition that there are things that BNSF could have done to protect itself other than just simply raise personal jurisdiction, because I could not take issue with that statement more strenuously than what I do now. And I want to discuss my taking issue with that in the context with Justice Alito's concerns about the application of the Dormant Commerce Clause. The Dormant Commerce Clause concerns expressed by Justice Alito are particularly acute when dealing with the railroad. It can't simply pick up its tracks and leave a state which imposes consent jurisdiction upon it by inference as a condition to its doing business in that state. It can't have its trains, westbound trains, stop at the Wisconsin-Minnesota border and then skirt the border and go around Minnesota and then continue west. Unlike a business that could protect itself because, say, look, I'm just not going to sell paper towels in Minnesota anymore because I don't like this idea of being sued in Minnesota for someone who misused paper towels in the state of Connecticut. So the Dormant Commerce Clause is particularly acute concern
but
in the situation.
But isn't that precisely how the Supreme Court distinguished Davis in Irving? I mean, because I think in Davis, the part of the problem was that the carrier didn't actually own the railroads, and they didn't actually operate the railroads. And so there was a commerce problem because the railroads weren't actually owned by the company, whereas in Irving, our Supreme Court said it's a different Commerce Clause question when the railroad actually owns the rails and has the employees and has the businesses and is regulating the business in the state. That's specifically what made Irving different than Davis. And to me, you know, your company's operations in Minnesota seem much more similar to Irving than what was happening in Davis.
Although, again, Your Honor, I think that Irving really no longer expresses what the concern is concerning the exercise of the Commerce Clause as a means of, as a defense to the exercise of improper exercise of personal jurisdiction in the state.
But even then, looking at, like, the current Commerce Clause, dormant Commerce Clause text, you know, it's a balance between what are the local, putative local interests and the effect on interstate commerce. And what do you make of the fact that the railroad's been operating for decades, 100 years, however long? I don't know this particular railroad, but and yet subject this whole time to personal jurisdiction and still operating in the state. What would be the argument that there's excessive burdens on commerce? I get the idea that in Davis that Alito was concerned about. That if you have to, you know, you just have a person, a salesperson who goes to a state, you're going to be thrown into that. But so just curious for your thoughts, even under the current standard, why is this an excessive burden on commerce?
I think under the current standard is even more of an excessive burden than that which we've considered in Davis or in other cases, because the railroad simply doesn't have a choice. It just doesn't have a choice as to whether it's going to do business in the state.
But it's already going to be subject to personal jurisdiction if it has, you know, a couple thousand employees and a lot of people. It's already presumably going to be subject to jurisdiction here with respect to those employees or issues that arise in the state.
We're not arguing that it can never be sued under any circumstances in Minnesota. If the accident happened in Minnesota, then that's specific jurisdiction. Okay. But in a situation like this, just because Burlington Northern runs tracks through Minnesota and has trains that run through Minnesota, has employees in Minnesota, isn't sufficient for it to be sued in Minnesota over an accident that happens in Montana involving an Iowa resident. And we know that from Tyrell. Tyrell has already said that Burlington Northern can't be sued in Montana despite the fact that it has more track and more employees in Montana than it has in the state of Minnesota.
I guess I thought that we were talking about, in this context, about the Dormant Commerce Clause, not the jurisdiction. So I'm wondering from the Commerce Clause perspective, let's say you know we don't, or the Minnesota Supreme Court, U.S. Supreme Court doesn't agree with you on the due process question. So just looking at the commerce question, how does it affect interstate commerce?
It affects interstate commerce again, Your Honor, because there's all sorts of components to commerce and the exercise of commerce and restrictions on the exercise of commerce. This one raises to the level of constitutional protection. The exercise of due process by forcing someone to come into state and defend themselves in an action that has insufficient contacts with that state. And my point being simply that even if you have an express statute, which may comport with jurisdictional requirements because it's express, can still violate the Commerce Clause because it forces that entity into a situation where it can't make a decision to protect itself. Your Honor, if I could very, very briefly.
Very briefly.
May I ask another question?
Of course.
I am still trying to grapple with, is it your argument that we should be applying the modern Dormant Commerce Clause test here rather than Irving?
Yes.
So then I guess I'm struggling with how, under the modern sort of iteration of the Dormant Clause, is it your argument that this law discriminates against? I guess I'm trying, what part of the Dormant Commerce Clause test are you thinking that this set of facts fits into, or the analysis of this particular statute? Are you saying that this discriminates against interstate commerce, or are you saying that it's not discriminatory, but it improperly affects? I guess I'm trying to figure out what part of the Dormant Commerce Clause test are you asking us to apply?
Which of the three parts?
Yeah.
It's the part that no state shall enact a law that shall restrict the transaction of interstate commerce, which is what I understand the Dormant Commerce Clause to be. And the way it impacts it in this situation is that if Minnesota law is held to stand the way it is in Rykoff-Sexson, then Burlington Northern has no choice but to subject itself to jurisdiction in Minnesota in cases that have otherwise no constitutional minimum contacts with the state of Minnesota, because it does not have the option to not do business in this state. And because it doesn't have the option of not doing business in this state, the Commerce Clause argument in this case is that Minnesota statute imposes an unconstitutional restriction on Burlington Northern's rights as a condition of its ability to do business in this state.
Can I just ask you to take that a little further? Because as I understand this, and by no means, I'm not an expert, the United States Supreme Court uses a three-part test to determine whether a law violates the dormant Commerce Clause, and I assume that's what my colleague is referring to when she says the modern iteration. The first part of the test concerns laws that discriminate on its face against interstate commerce. The second concerns laws that discriminate against interstate commerce on the basis of discriminatory purpose or effect. And the third part of the test concerns laws that regulate even-handedly and impose only incidental burdens on interstate commerce that are clearly excessive relative to punitive local benefits. So would we look at this under the third part of the test? In other words, the law applies to any business. They have to identify their person for service. So we're looking at whether Minnesota state law, which regulates even-handedly, imposes a burden on interstate commerce, I guess, which is excessive compared to the benefits conferred on the state of Minnesota. So why would you say that the burdens on the railroad are excessive as opposed to the benefits to the state of Minnesota?
I'll do it as quickly as I can. As the United States Supreme Court has determined that individual states can't claim a benefit of being able to subject every business that does business in its state to jurisdiction if it doesn't meet otherwise constitutional requirements. Okay, that's Daimler. In this particular situation, we have an implied statute that abrogates Daimler. As the Second Circuit said, it robs Daimler of meaning by backdoor thief.
So you're not really applying the three-part test.
First and third. And particularly in a situation like a railroad, Your Honor, which unlike some other business that could make an informed decision whether it wants to do business here, an interstate railroad doesn't have that luxury. And I think that's what Justice Alito was looking at in his concurrence that case, because he was concerned that even if we had a statute that conferred express consent to jurisdiction, requiring someone to expressly consent to the jurisdiction of a state as a condition to doing business there over cases that otherwise would not meet constitutional muster for the exercise of personal jurisdiction is an undue restriction on interstate commerce under both the first and third tests.
Any additional questions from the panel? Thank you. Thank you both for your arguments and your briefing this morning. It's been very helpful. The case is submitted. You'll have our decision within 90 days.